listening. Thank you for downloading. You're here with us at the Clock End Talk. You can follow us at clockend_talk. Deadline day. We've got plenty to talk about today, and also we've got to touch on that fucking Swansea game. But before we get into it, I'll introduce you to... He's here each and every week. How are you, Tony?
I'm not bad. Well, I've been better, but I'm not bad. Thanks yourself.
Oh, yeah, mate. Yeah, I suppose we're doing all right. We've got a bummer yang, but we lose 3 points, so it's a bit of a fucking catch-22, isn't it? Also, Schwinn, how are you, buddy?
Lukewarm. I think that describes me today after, as you said, Aubameyang signing, but dropping 3 silly points yesterday.
Yeah. Okay, well, where do we start? We've got deadline day to talk about. We will get through that one later. We've also got a special guest coming up. He's a man from Dortmund, so we'll speak to him a little bit later in the podcast. But we have to touch on this game, Tony, so take it away, mate. Swansea, Sid.
Yeah, it was just a horrible day throughout. So, I mean, obviously I'm speaking beyond the team here, but I get on a coach at midday for a 7:45 kickoff, made mildly interesting by sitting next to the club photographer and filming a 3-second video, which drained my battery twice due to a lot of people liking and following. And I decided to use the term I broke the internet. I didn't, but it sounds good. So anyway, we get to the game. It's pissing down with rain. It's freezing. And you just get that sense of, a lot of people around me were saying it, like, as an away fan, you just get that sense. When the weather's like that, you just think, well, Arsenal ain't going to turn up. Mm. Like they're not going to fancy it. And there was no point where we was in the game, even like, oh, we was playing well. I think we took the lead undeservedly. They equalised straight away through some poor defending from a number of players. And then it went to half-time and you thought, we're lucky to go in level. It can't get much worse. Because there's so many times that as a football fan, you've seen a team have an awful half, get away with it, and they think, shit, we can't carry on like this. But we somehow managed to get worse, which was staggering, really. But yeah, it was just a horrible, horrible day throughout.
If you had to name the worst player, who would you point out, Mike?
It's a difficult one because there's a reason for most people. I mean, Iwobi probably didn't do anything wrong. His pass completion was probably okay, but he just didn't do anything. Bellerin, again, just didn't do anything. He didn't defend well. He didn't attack well. He got caught out of position. Just, he literally offered nothing. Cech's obviously made a huge, huge error. And personally, I think he's partly at fault for the first goal as well. I was standing behind that goal and you could see the gap so clearly. And Sam Clucas scored pretty much the exact same goal at the Emirates in October. So, I mean, maybe in that short amount of time, the keeper doesn't have time to think that this player done this against us last time he played against them. But I knew that and I'm not paid $100,000 a week. So in that short amount of time, if I can remember it, I expect the players to be able to remember it. Obviously, Xhaka was partly at fault for the first goal as well. I said I think he was one of 4 people that was at fault for the first goal. The third goal, I've not watched it back because it was just too horrific. But it looks like he let Clucas go to an extent. But again, yes, you can partially blame him. You can partially blame Nacho for that as well. But I think when you're chasing a game at 2-1, you expect your players to be 5-10 yards higher up the pitch, which they were. So then if he's let Clucas go, it's never forgivable, but it's more understandable. But yeah, I think it's difficult to say a worst player because there's so many of them I could pick out for just, I mean, I'd even say as good as he is and the assist was unbelievable, but Ozil had a very, very quiet game, just didn't do much, and he was one of the 4 players that fought for the first goal as well. So it's difficult. I'll just round it up as a shit performance throughout. Elneny was probably our best player and he got dragged after about an hour because he was on a booking. And I would say he was our best player at maybe a 5 out of 10, a 6 if you're being very generous. Mm. And I think that sums up your day when your best player's a 5 or a low 6. That sums up your day.
A lot of people probably put a claim Monreal was not the man of the match in a losing team, but probably the best. But
But he was at fault for the third, and he scored, but he was at fault for the third, and I just don't think he'd done anything in between. I'm not saying he was bad, but he was literally between scoring and making a mistake for a goal, he'd done literally nothing in between. Like, he got up and down, he tried, but he just didn't. He was ineffective, but all of our players are ineffective. It's not a criticism of Monreal. It's a criticism of Arsenal Football Club.
Before I go to Schwinn, you brought up an interesting point that I just want to ask you. You said that that first goal, it was a similar goal at the Emirates, so Cech probably should have been aware of it. You were aware of it, him being paid a fortune of money. Is that something that Arsenal players do or management do or something that where they watch videos on where these strikers score from opposition?
It really depends sort of player to player. Unless there's a key man that we've identified, we've got to stop him. So you'll often see plans put in place for another team's number 10, or if they've got a star striker, or even if they've not got a star striker, if they've got someone pretty good, that the defence as a unit will work on how they're going to stop him. When it comes to keepers, it's purely on them, pretty much. Mm-hmm. If they look at individual players, I mean, look, it's difficult with Klukas because I think he's only got one goal this season, and it was against us until last night. I mean, he may have others, I don't know. I haven't looked at the stats, but he doesn't score too many. So if you're looking at ways to stop each player, he's probably one of the ones that you wouldn't identify as to we have to look at how to stop him.
Yeah.
I mean, look, we've seen in years gone by where we've let Robin cut in on his left foot when we've been playing Bayern Munich, and you don't know if that's just Robin so good at doing it, but it looks like they've let him do it pretty easily, and you don't need to watch videos to stop that. Like, I mean, to know he's going to do it, to stop it, obviously, is very difficult. But so it's difficult. It depends on firstly the position, and then sometimes on the player individually or the individual unit. But when it was a keeper like Cech, it will depend on him individually. But I'd be surprised if he has looked at Klukas. As I said, because there's no guarantee Klukas will start. He's not really a goal scorer. But even so, he was playing in that game. So you should remember how they scored, because I wasn't playing and I remember how they scored.
Yeah. Okay, Schwinn, I'll go to you, mate. What was your take on the Swansea game?
Well, just to quickly start with, Mkhitaryan was on the bench. I think most of us expected him to be eased in, and he did make his debut yesterday, so we'll probably get into that a little bit, because he did seem bright and not quite low on confidence. I think he suddenly had a switch of mentality. We all know he was wanting to leave Man United, and we all know that he's always wanted to play under Arsene Wenger, who lets his players, express themselves. So that was pretty evident, but we'll come to that. And, of course, Jack Wilshere missed out through illness. So I think we can expect him for our next game. I think it's just a bout of illness, nothing to be worried about. But yeah, as Tony said, insipid. The performance was very sluggish from the get-go. You know, as Tony said, I mean, it was one of those days where the weather sort of beat us before we left the tunnel, almost. It felt like we were second to all 50-50 balls. We were, our feet seemed heavy. I remember speaking with Tony yesterday after the game, where there was a moment early on in the game where Lacazette had to chase a long ball, and Federico Fernandez was chasing the ball with him. And Lacazette had a step on him and still couldn't get to the ball earlier. I bet on any other day he does. But I think we were beaten for something. We were beaten before we started the game. And that was evident from our performance. I mean, I think Jordan Ayew had the game of his life, arguably. And that he was a constant threat to Mustafi and Koscielny, who were pretty much the only players who were in our half defending. Everyone else was camped in their half. But we couldn't switch gears, and we just didn't show any we couldn't pick up momentum, and we couldn't show any drive. It was a very hard game to watch. I'm sure most of our listeners and all Arsenal fans would agree with that. And it's one that we would all like to erase from our memories.
Since we're talking about the game, and we usually save this till the end, but we've got a couple of user questions, because there was a lot of our followers as well as Arsenal fans very frustrated with the performance. So, and anything that's not been asked, we'll pick up on Tony as well. So, but Vish asked, Tony, What would the atmosphere and reaction of the players and coaches be like after yesterday's dismal performance? Do the players shrug it off, knowing there are no repercussions from the manager, or do the players lay into each other demanding answers for such poor performances?
The players will not lay into each other. To be honest, usually they'll go in either the next day or they might have the next day off, so they'll go in 2 days later and watch the videos and see where they went wrong. It's difficult when it's individual mistakes because they don't like to highlight them. Because when you say, if it's like team mistakes, like the first goal they'll look at, because there was, as I said, four mistakes leading up to the goal. So that can be fixed. Whereas, say the second goal, Cech's mistake was a freak mistake. That doesn't mean I'm saying there's a reason for it, but there's no point watching that over and again, because he could do that same thing 100 times and it wouldn't go wrong, like 1,000 times. How many times has he kicked the ball and that hasn't happened? So they don't look at stuff like that. I mean, they won't be tearing into each other, because, I mean, he says, I know where he's coming from, but he says lack of repercussions, but what does he want the repercussions to be? I don't think you can really accuse anyone for a lack of effort. You can accuse them for a lack of ability on the day or a lack of a good performance. But so you can't start like fining people or suspending people just because they've tried hard but it's not gone for them. Again, I'm not saying that's acceptable, but I don't. When people say, "Oh, there should be repercussions," I don't know what they want as them repercussions and really how you can enforce them. And I said you can't start docking wages willy nilly. I know we think of it as stupid, like because footballers earn stupid money, we think of it as, oh, fine, a week's wages is not much. But I know if I had a bad day at work and someone tried to fine me a week's wages, I would be fighting them. So you can't, I know they earn stupid money, but you can't start doing things like that. Like, it's just, you, even though the money is obviously unobtainable and unrealistic to us, you have to apply the same rules. So if you had, as I said, 90 bad minutes of a week, and someone said, "Oh, I'm not paying you this week," there'd be problems. And obviously, you don't want problems in the football side.
I totally agree. I'll stick with Tony on this one from the Texas Gooner, because for your information, we had this discussion with Schwinn already. So, Tony, who is more to blame for switching off the mental lapse, as well as continuously being outfought and outplayed away from home by the inferior opposition, the players themselves or the manager and staff? Should the manager hold the players more accountable than he does?
I mean, I'll answer that in reverse order. Yeah, he should hold them more accountable. I think he does seem to give them a free pass. Not a free pass, but he lets them off lightly. You hear sort of once or twice a year that he's really ripped into them. But like, just comparing him to, say, a Ferguson, he would lay into them every single time they played like that, and it seems to not be the case at Arsenal. There's a big difference between playing well and losing or not getting the result, which can happen. Like, say after we lost to United at home, it would be very hard for him to tear into them, and the same way Ferguson wouldn't have torn into a team like that, because it's just not been your day. You've not done everything right, but you put a good performance in and you've been a bit unlucky. Whereas when the performance is completely abject, as I said, I think Wenger will let them get away with it to a certain extent. I mean, we heard reports after we lost 3-0 away to Palace last year that he tore into the dressing room and probably a couple of other times. But for me, when you play like that, it should be every week. Mm-hmm. In terms of who's accountable, I think it's everyone top to bottom. Again, barring potentially Mkhitaryan for Iwobi, you looked at that starting 11 and you'd say, yeah, that's enough. That's probably what I would have done apart from that one swap. So with what was available. So once Wenger's picked his team, and if they're not battling out on a pitch, if they're not winning them 50-50 balls, he has no control over whether a player wins a 50-50 ball or not. So yes, you can maybe blame him for a lack of motivation at the start, but that is an individual choice. If you're going to go and go make sure you get to that ball first and win your personal battle, that's up to the player. I don't want to pick on anyone, so, but a lot of the individual players that lost their battles last night, there was a lot of battles that, say, a Jack wouldn't have lost because he has that inner motivation to do it himself. And if all of the players had that, then you'd lose a lot less 50-50 battles. And So yeah, I think that so that part has to go on the player, and obviously the pre-match and not changing things as well has to go on Wenger. So I think everyone's to blame.
Okay, Schwinn, Sam Spade asks, how much input do you think AW Wenger has had on ins and outs this window? Just seems to me that he's very un-Wengerish January window.
Before I get to Sam's question, I do have a comment on the question that Vish asked, because once he finished his question, he went on to say something to the tune of this. I'm inclined to think that the players would all merely sit watching Teletubbies and Barney rather than replay the match to analyze how to prevent another dismal performance. This team had the mental fortitude of a two-year-old. Now, of course, this question came at a very heated moment right after the game, and I'm just like Vish, there were many other people on Arsenal Twitter that were accusing Arsenal players of not having mental fortitude. I find that so bloody disheartening to read, because I think most of the times fans forget that the players don't want to lose. No one steps onto the pitch to lose. Secondly, we have players like Granit Xhaka and Henrik Mkhitaryan on our team who have gone through some serious shit through their young lives. I mean, Granit Xhaka recently had an interview with The Guardian. I'm not sure who's read that, but I highly urge everyone to go read that. And he basically says that his motivation in life to succeed is down to the sacrifices his dad made in a Kosovan prison where he was beaten, on a daily basis. Henrik Mkhitaryan had to flee Armenia because of the war in Armenia and had to go live in Brazil not knowing Portuguese. These people come from absolutely nothing. Just because they make a lot of money doesn't mean they're not human. And yes, we should be, criticizing players for a performance like what we saw yesterday, probably our worst performance of the season, and there have been a few. But to sort of put them in this light where we see them as not being human is something that really pains me. And it's very unfair, because at that point, when you're taking criticism that far enough, no one's going to take you seriously, and nor are the players. And that's something that everyone suffers from, Just because you take it a notch too far, it's just gone over everyone's head. So that's just something I was thinking of as Tony was answering what Vish had to say. As far as Sam's question goes, I mean, it's hard to say. No one knows what the ins and outs, the workings of Arsenal Football Club are. And he's probably right to an extent where Arsenal doesn't have a lot of say in it. But to completely rid Arsenal of the equation, I think is not something we should do, because at the end of the day, football is in the now. And right now, he is the manager. If someone came up, if Gazidis or Sven, whoever came to Arsene and puts a name and Arsene thinks he's not going to play, he's not going to fit into the team, they're not going to go and buy them, because Arsene is just going to put them in the reserve squad or put them on the bench. If the manager doesn't think a player is not going to fit in the team, they're not going to play. It's as simple as that. So I'm sure there is a little bit of discussion going on, and I know for a fact, as do all of our listeners, that there are more cooks in the kitchen, if you will, but there's no way Arsene is not involved in the process. He definitely is.
Vish also commented back to me basically yesterday. He was saying a question. Tez, sorry to say, your man Xhaka is fucking slow, lazy, useless wanker who can't track a running to save his life. The first and third goals are his fault. He gave Klukas a free pass on goal instead of 50 million for a striker. How about a midfielder who can shore up our defence? While we're at it, rather than spend the money on a new goalkeeper as well, who can fucking save a penalty and prevent us conceding silly goals? Look, first of all, I'll mention about Xhaka. Yes, I'm a fan of Xhaka. Yes, I want him to succeed. I too, like Schwinn just said, have read the backstory of Xhaka, and It's not easy to come to a country, be paid a shitload of money. He's no Messi or Ronaldo, but the guy has come to London and he's trying his fucking best. I want him to succeed as a player. I get behind all our players. Yes, I criticise, but Xhaka is one player that I really am a fan of. Yesterday he didn't have the best game. However, there was another, 10 other blokes on the field that didn't have the best game as well. So I think to be critical of one player each week when you've got 10 other players on the field, I think you've got to have a good look at the rest of the team. Tony, have you got any add on any of that?
Yeah, I mean, I still think just like Vicious, I saw this tweet come in just after the final whistle and tempers were high. If the listeners saw some of the things I was saying to use to in our private conversation, they'd never listen to the show again. Some of the opinions I would say I was airing just because I was angry. So I get that the question's born of frustration, as Schwinn said earlier, but blaming Xhaka purely for the first goal is ridiculous. First of all, Koscielny's clearance is awful. Then Ozil's touch is awful. Then his pass is awful, straight to Alfie Mawson. Then Hector Bellerin is our furthest player forward, which leaves Xhaka. The reason he let Lucas go, it's the wrong decision. It is a mistake. It's up there with the rest of the mistakes. But look at it again. They had a wide man that was completely free. So Xhaka, our central midfielder, bear in mind El Neni was meant to be playing deeper than him yesterday. So he's a central midfielder. He's not playing as a defensive midfielder. Finds himself at right back versus two unmarked players. One being Lucas inside him and one being, I think it was Olsen outside him, but it was there was definitely someone there. He's gone outside as if the ball's going wide and the ball's gone inside him into Lucas, who's one-on-one. The mistake is defend your goal first. Don't try and preempt. Defend your goal. If the ball goes wide and that guy's free, there's not much you can really do. I mean, saying that, if it goes wide and they put the cross in and someone scores, so he probably gets blamed for not going out to him earlier. But when your defensive midfielder is in... Well, not even your defensive midfielder, sorry. Your centre midfielder is in the right-back position with two men and no help, you have to be looking at other people as well. So, yes, he did make a mistake, but that was, that was a team mistake. I'd blame Cech for leaving his near post open. Koscielny's clearance was awful. Ozil's touch was awful. Ozil's pass was awful. Bellerin's positioning was an absolute joke. And then Xhaka made a fundamental error in not defending the goal because he went to go to the wrong man. So I get that the emotions were high, but watch the game and look at where the mistakes were. Don't just pick on one player because he's flavour of the month to be picked on at the moment. I'm not saying it wasn't a mistake, but as I said, when five players make a mistake, I think to pick one out is nonsense, really.
As soon as Arsenal have a bad game, Shaq is the man that seems to cop the shit.
Yeah, I mean, look, he wasn't good yesterday.
I agree.
In a sense, I'm not defending him because he was partially at fault for the first goal, but he was in the same amount as... Look, Koscielny's clearance was bad, but probably forgivable. Ozil's touch was bad, but he recovered it. His pass is awful. It's not... I mean, it's almost unforgivable. Bellerin's positioning is completely unforgivable. Look, he's in advance of the ball when they're on the attack, and he's our right back. He was playing back four, so it's not wing back. He's our right back. Look at the difference in position between Monreal. Look at the still image, the one that shows the gap where Lucas went to try and blame Xhaka. And look at the difference in the line between Bellerin and Monreal. Obviously, they're on opposite sides of the pitch, but Bellerin is 20 to 25 yards further forward. They're playing in the same position, and the ball is on Bellerin's side of the pitch. So the danger is on Bellerin's side of the pitch, and he's in advance of the ball. That is unforgivable. So it is, as I said, Xhaka has made a mistake, but it's as much a mistake as any of the others, really, apart from maybe Koscielny, because it was a poor clearance. I mean, it wasn't a clearance. He passed it to Ozil, but Ozil had nothing on, and it was stupid giving him the ball in that situation. That was probably the lesser of the four mistakes, but the others are all as bad as each other. The mantra as a keeper is don't get beat at your near post. That's what Cech done. If Cech saves that, then... All of them, if Cech covers his near post and pushes it around for a corner, all of them other four mistakes become not even talking points.
MAA Gunner, he mentioned that while we're taking off El Neni, basically, and as Tony touched on it earlier, El Neni, yes, I agree with what MAA Gunner is saying, that he was the best of the midfields yesterday, but I understand that it was the yellow card, Tony. That's why he was taken off.
Well, yeah, you've got to assume so. He's in a combative area. He was trying to take up two roles. Not he was obviously instructed to. It's not a criticism of him, but he's in a competitive area on a slippery pitch where touches can go a little bit long and you stretch for one and you're booked as soon as you make contact. He was our only player on the booking, and it was pretty sensible. I think the choice of change was a bit weird. Not going light for light, because at the time we were still at 1-1 and we was having a lot of the ball. We wasn't creating much, but we were controlling the ball. And I think Wenger's gone for, well, we've got to take him off because he's on the booking and we'll get someone that can maybe create something while we're controlling that ball. But to change the whole shape, I thought was a bit strange. As I said, I can understand the reason for it. And if we go on to win that game 2-1 or 3-1, you call it a genius move. We've gone on to lose it, so you can question it. I mean, I think it'd probably be a bit hard to criticise it, but it's definitely questionable.
MAA Gunner goes on to say, whose great idea was it to make that kit? And whose outstanding idea was it to keep wearing it? And he's actually talking about, I don't think we've won a game in that kit, have we? Oh, I might have been Sydney FC in a preview game, a pre-season game, but that's about it.
No, that was in the black one. The only game we've won is Bartek Borislav away.
There you go. Yeah, it was. It was in the black. The black and pink was the Sydney FC. Yeah, I agree totally. MAA pissed the fucking thing off. Schwinn, when a new player signs, wouldn't they want to know the future of the manager due to his contract ending in a year? If Wenger stays, why have they chosen to come if he's leaving? Were they mentioned in the negotiations?
Well, I mean, it's a fair assumption on which the question is based, but I think there's one thing important to remember is that football moves really fast. I mean, we all knew for certain that Alexis Sanchez is a Man City player. But Man United came in at the right moment and wrapped up the deal before City could even blink and have, you know, maybe another chance to go in for negotiations. I don't know how it turned out, but I think the point I'm trying to make is pretty clear. Aubameyang is an opportunistic player. He's been trying to get out of Dortmund for a while, and it hasn't materialized. Arsenal came knocking this time out, and I think he saw an opening and he made a push for it. Having said that, I also think Aubameyang is not a long-term Arsenal player. I think, personally, his eyes are set on Real Madrid. They always have been. Now, age is going against him, so it's a little difficult for him to really make that move maybe within a year and really prove himself if he really does want Real Madrid come knocking. But I think that those two elements sort of really push the transfer more than anything. And I read some word earlier today. I don't know how true it is. Maybe Tony can offer insight on this. But apparently, if he don't make Champions League, he's got a release clause in his contract, which is not that high. I think the figure I read was maybe closer to 50 million. So, I mean, that's another thing that tells me, if it is true, that he sees this as a stepping stone, which I'm okay with. I mean, if that's what his deal is, and if he is performing for us week in, week out with 100% effort, that's what I want from him. I would hold no bones against him. But in terms of a player switching clubs, the football world moves so fast right now in modern times that it's really hard for you to wait. And I think, I mean, people might bring up the Van Dijk saga and how Liverpool did go back for him, but I think that's a unique situation. I don't think it happens too often. I mean, again, Coutinho was another special case. But when it comes to certain players, they want the opportunity, and sometimes they may not even want the opportunity, but are unsettled by, suddenly an opportunity coming towards them. So it's a very good question, and it can pan out either way. As for Aubameyang, we wait and watch what happens with that.
Okay, don't give all the cards away yet. We've got a fucking another hour to go. okay, just quickly, because you were talking about Aubameyang, Adam Cohen, he's put a little cheeky one in here. Which superhero mask will Aubameyang celebrate with first?
Oh, he better not. I'm not a fan of those antics. I'm also not a fan of how we've just given him the number 14. I mean, you got to earn that at our club. And he's a great player. Don't get me wrong. He's proven himself in Dortmund and Saint-Étienne. But this is Arsenal. You have to, whenever you come to a new club, you have to prove yourself there in a new league and this and that. I like having a personality around, but I also believe in the tradition that our club has been built on. There's a certain class that we represent, and these sort of antics are not really something I stand by. It's a personal opinion, of course, and you guys might disagree, but that's just how I feel.
Yeah, sorry, Adam. I asked the bloke who thought Aubameyang wasn't a good signing, so probably more.
That's right. That's exactly right. Tony is probably better suited for that.
I totally forgot about that. Tony, what superhero mask, mate?
To be honest, as long as he's scoring, I couldn't care if he gets a big inflatable penis out and goes as knobhead man. I don't care about the antics. I think like, it'd be bring some lightheartedness to the fan base. I know he's done Spider-Man and Batman before, but a lot of people have been, because look, he clearly looks at social media, whether it's him or someone in his team, and a lot of people have been linking him to Batman more, like the Batman, the master celebration. We've seen like the Batlight or the Batcall, whatever it's called. I don't know, I'm not really into that comic stuff. Mm. So I'd imagine if he is going to do that sort of stuff, it would be Batman first, because that's just more what's been sort of said on social media, and it's very clear that that does have an influence on what he does.
As a fan for yourself sitting at the Emirates, it's and I've heard many say that it's hardly much of an atmosphere at the Emirates, and like I can't talk from experience, only what you guys tell me, you know, I hear from Robbie, an Arsenal fan TV, also saying that something needs to be done as well. But what I'm getting at is a Batman, it'd really encourage some fans and get some excitement around the stadium, wouldn't it?
I don't really think so, to be honest, because when you score, the problem is with the atmosphere at the Emirates, it's not that it's quiet in a sense. It is. The problem is it's quiet. We're loud when we score or when there's an incident, but we pretty much sit in silence the rest of the time. That's the issue. So if he scores, we're going to go wild anyway, regardless of what he does.
Yeah.
And then if he puts a mask on, look, it might get a little bit of a laugh after. Some people might not even notice because they turn around to celebrate or run up and down celebrating. So I don't think it would add it. As I said, it adds a bit of humour to maybe look back on after or look back on a match of the day or for the fans watching on TV who they get a close-up of the players celebrating. Obviously, when you're in the stands, there's limbs going everywhere. So the view's obstructed and whatnot. So I think for the match-going fans, as I said, it's a little bit of a laugh, but I don't think it would add to the atmosphere, to be honest.
Okay. Tayeb, sorry if I got that.
that's a tongue twister.
It is. Tony, I have a question. Do you seriously consider Arsenal as a big club? On the pitch, not financially, do you think lower and mid-table teams go into games against Arsenal scared or careful? I personally think that even non-league teams will fancy their chances against Arsenal.
All right, so the question was pretty reasonable until the last sentence, so we'll pretend he didn't say that. Look, football runs in cycles. You could say, look, Man United, for example, just to pick on them, they definitely had the fear factor under Ferguson. You went there and you'd pretty much lost before you went there for probably 17 of the 19 other Premier League clubs. Do we still have that at the Emirates? Almost certainly, and our record shows that. And it's very rare teams come to play against us at the Emirates. And if we was as bad as everyone said and everyone was as confident as I think I would pronounce it Tayeb, I might be wrong. If everyone was as confident of beating us as he said, then they would come to play and they would come and beat us. The fact is, only United have beat us this year, and as arguably in one of our best performances at home. Chelsea have come there and not got a win. Tottenham we've beat. Liverpool have not got a win. We've led in both them two games we've drawn. So out of, I don't know how many we've had, but the three games we've dropped points, we've led in two of them and arguably played very well in the other. So, I mean, I don't think it's a big club, small club debate, but to say everyone comes to Arsenal with confidence is nonsense. You look at our away record, and that's where there is an argument that we can be got at. But you know, I've been at all of them, so it's hard to recall them all. But teams haven't been coming and beating us, apart from Liverpool, I don't think, and arguably Man City. No one's come and just dismissed us and come and actually beat us off the park. Look at Swansea last night. They fully deserved to win. I'm not denying that. but the majority of the time they had nine men behind the ball. It's an embarrassment for us that they still had the better chances, but they didn't just come and think, oh, this Arsenal lot are a joke, we're just going to go and beat them. The same, Watford were the same, we dominated much of the game. Trying to think of other ones that we lost a bit that have been very similar. Southampton, we got a draw last minute, but again, exactly the same thing. West Ham, we got a draw, very similar. So look, these teams ain't thinking of Arsenal, oh, we've got that joke team that can't win away today, we're just going to go and batter them. If you don't play Arsenal with caution, you're in trouble. Unless you are that much better than us, and Liverpool were on the day, and City were on the day. But I'd say they're the only two games where we've been outclassed in a footballing sense. And as I said, that's not taking anything away from Swansea, because they did deserve to win. I'm just trying to think of it of other ways where that's sort of been the case. Again, Bournemouth had everyone behind the ball, and we just couldn't break them down. So I think, yes, teams still fear playing Arsenal. I would say a better question would be, and it was why when we speak to the guy from Dortmund later, I'm going to ask him how Aubameyang is against packed defences, because that's our problem. Look, we know Aubameyang's got pace to burn, but teams don't give us that space in behind to run into. So it'll be interesting to hear from him how Aubameyang deals with teams that they're defending on their GD area, so they kind of nullify pace. So that, for me, that's a better question. Why can't we break down deep defences? Not that these teams just not respect us and think of us as this team that are going to be easy to beat, because that's far from the case.
Now, Schwinn and Tony, you can add to this as well. I'm just going to rattle off. There's a bit, look, and this is the frustration after the game the other day. So there is quite a few questions. Darren O'Reilly, so you'll get the theme of things. Why hasn't Wenger been sacked? If Wenger, another guy at fourth Arsenal, if Wenger doesn't leave at the end of the season, won't it be the same as last season with the press constantly asking, is he staying or is he leaving? They're going to say, do you think that if a new manager came in, would he show that some of these players were slag-offs? Lacka Lamar says, and Lamar, geez, we're still on that. My only hope is Wenger leaving this summer. Should I continue to hope? Cullum, and then so you're getting the theme there, boys. Daniel Smith, he says, when the fuck will Wenger be leaving? So yeah, lads, if you want to just comment on a couple of them.
Schwinn? Well, I'll start, and I'll say that a week ago we just made a cup final over beating Chelsea over two legs, and at that moment everyone was sitting on Arsene's dick. Choose people. Choose what you want. Do you want him in? Do you want him out? And then stick with it. Because yesterday what happened was not Wenger's fault. He set them up for success. We enjoyed possession throughout the 90 minutes and did not create. There is only so much a manager can do. I have no problems with Arsene Wenger based on yesterday's result. The recurring problems are, of course, an issue. You know, Granit Xhaka, for example, needs a little more of a guiding hand, because there are certain mistakes he makes that are showing again and again over the course of this season and last season. You know, that is where you do criticize the manager, because, you know, he is unable to identify the mistakes that are happening again and again. Those are the ones you want to stop. You know, something new is difficult to stop, but something you can see again and again needs to be stopped. I mean, I tweeted after the game that the blame of yesterday's game solely rests on the players, in my opinion. And, you know, you guys might differ with me on this. But, I mean, there's absolutely no reason to drag the manager into this. I don't understand. I mean, what else do you want the manager to do? I mean, I'm actually asking you guys, do you think I'm way too off here? Because I am very much a supporter of Arsene Wenger. I have always been. But I'm happy to have a conversation about this and see what you guys feel about it.
So coming from my point of view, look, I think people were over the top on Wenger last night. As I've said, you can blame everyone of the players. And I think he partially has a blame for some tactical decisions I explained earlier, making the change, not the sub of Elneny, but changing the shape when we was controlling the game, or controlling the ball at least, was a bit strange. But I think the frustration comes with most people in that he's the common denominator. We've been not as bad as this, but we've had the same problems for maybe 5 years now. And the common denominator, we've had different squads, different teams, different captains, different players in key positions. And the common denominator is, unfortunately, Arsene Wenger. So I get it. Look, I don't want him to be Arsenal's manager anymore. I've made my views on that very clear. But I also don't blame him for everything, because there are some fans that are like that. They want him out so much that anything that happens is Wenger's fault, which, look, I don't agree with. So I can see where they're coming from. I just don't think they're objective with it. And they may listen to this and think I'm talking nonsense and tell me why the grass being the wrong length is Arsene Wenger's fault. Or obviously I'm making up an example there. But, yeah, I just think people have lost because it's been going on so long, they've lost their objectiveness. So everything that goes wrong is him. But I do feel, as I said, he's the common denominator across multiple squads with multiple different players in different positions, multiple tactical systems. The one thing that's remained the same, apart from the poor performances, is the manager.
I've been meaning to fucking write a letter to Wenger about that fucking grass. Can he sort something out with the groundsman? Oh, fuck, mate.
No, he does it himself. You know, he does everything.
Okay, there was one other, and I've just lost it. It was about Cech, and we're comparing him. Tony, you may have seen it.
Tony.
Yeah.
It must have. Again, I saw this as I came out of the ground. I can only assume, again, it was frustration after the game, because you can't honestly compare Cech to Almunia. I don't know if that listener, whoever it was, heard me say a few weeks ago that Cech had the best, Almunia has our biggest percentage of penalty saves, and that's why they decided to compare him to him. But I think with Cech with penalties, yeah, look, he hasn't saved one, but to be honest, there's an answer to that. Stop fucking giving them away. As I've said this before, the keeper's not really expected to save a penalty. By law of averages, he should save one, but no, you can't compare him to Almunia. I think a more interesting one would be comparing him to Fabianski, because whenever Fabianski got a run, he was a decent keeper for us, and he can actually kick the ball. My biggest grievance with Cech, and I'm not saying this because of last night's mistake, even when he's kicking the ball cleanly, his kicking is awful. For a team like Arsenal, your keeper probably is required to kick the ball more than he is to save it. I think he flaps a bit at crosses. But yeah, I mean, you can't compare him to Almunia. It's non-comparable. Like, you could probably go through the amount of mistakes. A compilation of Almunia's mistakes would last a hell of a lot longer than a compilation of Cech mistakes.
Yeah, sorry, I just can't find who that was now. But anyway, I will find it. I just want to ask, because I fucking give Lacazette the kiss of death. I tweeted out about Lacazette, you know, he's just hang in with him. And I just want to get your guys' thoughts on Lacazette. Well, because he's copping a lot of criticism. It was more, and I think you may have seen the tweet, that I said, you know, Thierry Henry, he bloody, what do you have, 0 goals in the first 8 games? And then, 2 goals in 17. So I just said, look, let's hang there with Lacazette. And then he played fucking like a busted ass against Swansea. So I give him the kiss of death. But I just, a lot of people are criticising him. So I'll just get your boys' thoughts, Tony.
To be honest, my problem, I don't think enough people are criticising him. I think everyone's giving him a free ride. He was awful again yesterday. And people have heard me say this before, I want him to be good. Believe me, I want him to be good. I don't travel up and down the country every week to watch him be shit and think, yes, I've said he's not playing well, so I'm glad he's not playing well. No, I want to be proved wrong. I want him to score a hat-trick every week. So don't get me criticising him, confused for me wanting him to be bad. But he does not have an appetite to score goals. His positioning, his link-up play is very good, and everyone keeps saying that. Whenever you criticise him, but he links up very well. Yes, brilliant, he does. We brought him to score goals. At the moment, he does not attack the goal. There was one yesterday that was so clear. Ramsey backheeled the ball to Mkhitaryan. Mkhitaryan flashed it across the box. It just evaded Giroud at the front post. Any striker in and around the six-yard box, in the middle of the goal or at the back post, tapping. Easy, just knocking it into an open goal. Lacazette was on the edge of the area. what are you doing? Like, want to score, please. I appreciate that your build-up's lovely and you're technically a very good footballer. But unless you have that appetite to score, I'd love to see a heat map, because I doubt how many times in the game he was stood in a goal-scoring position. And people keep saying he's not getting the service. Well, one, he's got Ozil behind him, so service is never really going to be an issue. Two, other people are managing to score, so they're getting service. What is it special about him? I just think people are giving him a free ride because they want him to be good. Like, I don't think any defender thinks, shit, I'm playing against Lacazette, because he doesn't challenge you in the air competitively in terms of score goals. He comes short and links the play, but that's all in front of you. You can just let him do that without causing you much damage. He doesn't run in behind, and when he does, he's not the quickest, as the example Schwinn pulled out earlier. I mean, I think he is quicker than that instance, but he's not the electric striker that everyone thought he was. I get it's his first year in the league, and he's probably, what a lot of people that come over from France say is that they're still playing with, like, knocks from a game that was 2 months ago. Because I remember Giroud famously done an interview after his first season, and he said he was never fit. And apart from his debut, he was never, ever fit. But people just kept saying to him, this is England. This. He said, if you're, basically he was saying, in France, if you're 80% fit, you don't play. He's like, well, in England, if you're 80% fit, that's your 100% fit, because you will never be 100% fit. So I get all that. But for me, it's the choices and the decisions and the football intelligence that Lacazette is showing that's bad, not his ability. And the thing is, look, people are saying to me, like, oh, I'm on a bit of an agenda about it because I openly criticise him. But I think people are going the other way. They so want him to be good that every time he does anything half decent, like when I said he was bad against Chelsea, I've got loads of people saying, oh, but he got an assist. You mean the ball he tried to cut back to the edge of the area that a defender blocked into the 6-yard box? Well done on the running. Well done on holding the ball up. Done very well. But don't start telling me because he got a deflected assist that he had a good game, because he didn't. And again, yesterday, I think, like, yesterday was one of his worst performances. So I'm picking a point to highlight a point. But again, people just go, oh, I didn't get the service. If you're not in an area, if you're not standing in the middle of the goal, you're not going to get service. You're standing on the right wing or 45 yards out from goal. How do you want him to be served? You give him the ball to feet 45 yards out. That's all you can do. We gave him a chance to run in behind, and he wasn't capable. So what do you want? If we keep doing that and we keep playing long balls and losing the ball, you just blame Xhaka for overhitting the ball every time, or whoever plays the ball. You literally, I think people are so busy trying to defend him that they're just not actually seeing what he's doing.
Yeah, okay. Now, if you want to send that heat map to Tony at clockend_talk, because I'd be very interested to have a look at it as well, Tony.
The heat map might be half decent, because had the ball wide and he kind of ambles about in the middle of the box but doesn't want the cross because he knows he's not going to win it in the air. The touch map would be very interesting.
Okay, so I'm sure we've got some followers out there that can send us through that one. Schwinn, you got any on Lacazette, mate?
I mean, a bit. I'm in complete agreement with Tony for the most of what he said. I think there's two things that have not helped Lacazette. Number one is playing the first half of the season with Sanchez, and then Sanchez suddenly packing his bags and moving up north to Manchester. You know, I mean, when you're new at a club, it takes time to build your chemistry. It takes time to get used to the league and everything that comes with it. And we did him no favors by playing him alongside Alexis, more so than we played him with Mesut, because, of course, Mesut was recovering from an injury, and then, of course, he falls sick every now and then. So that's something to keep in mind. And the second thing I would say is Ramsey. I mean, Ramsey, before he got injured, was probably our player of the season so far, along with Nacho Monreal up there. And Ramsey's biggest asset is those late runs. And what that does is that it occupies another defender in the box. And that leaves Lacazette a little more room. So I think, to just complement what Tony just said, I think those are another two things that have affected his downfall, if you will, because he did score against whoever we played, who beat 4-0 or 4-1, whatever that is. It just feels like a distant memory at this point. But I don't think it did him any good, because when he drops deep to get the ball, there's nothing happening in front of him, just like there's nothing happening in front of the other players when they have the ball. So it's hard for him to be working that hard and still not reaping the benefits of all this hard work. So I agree that he's been, as Tony said, he's not been influential enough, and he's nowhere close to the goal to be threatening the goal, which is his one job, if you will. But we also did him no favors, I think, initially by playing him alongside Alexis Sanchez. I think that's something that we should remember. And now the squad has changed even more with Henrik Mkhitaryan and Aubameyang in. So apart from the fact that a player usually needs 1 year in any way to embed himself, I think Lacazette's incubation period is going to be a little bit of a stretch, and we might not see the best of him this season, purely down to the revolving door of players that he's been playing with.
Yeah, no worries. I agree. Like I just want him to succeed, but I get both your points. So we'll just see, wait and see what happens, I suppose. Okay, let's get into some transfer stuff. Deadline day. Our little mate Giroud, he's gone. Debuchy, big signing in Aubameyang. Tony, fill us in, mate.
Yes, so, I mean, in terms of the transfers that happened, I don't really need to tell anyone. I'm very, very disappointed to lose Giroud. The window's closed without getting in a replacement. And people will say Aubameyang is his replacement, but then we didn't replace Sanchez. And if you say Mkhitaryan was his, we didn't replace Walcott. Either way, we've lost three attacking players and replaced them with two. I think the three players we've lost combined for, I think it was 65 Premier League goals last year. And we've replaced them with probably five that Mkhitaryan got, and obviously Aubameyang got what he got in the Bundesliga. So I'm a bit disappointed in that. I think it doesn't give us a plan B, which it doesn't give us another option. I think yesterday showed, even though look, Giroud already had one foot out the door, when he came on, we slightly changed how we played. When we got the ball wide, we was happy to pull it in because he has half a chance of winning it. So I think we've lost a plan B. And I was talking to one of our on Twitter. Me and one of our regular listeners were tweeting each other the day before Swansea when it looked like it was going to happen, but hadn't happened yet. And I think my point still remains that as we've not replaced him and we sold him for an initial £15.8 million, I believe £15.8 million has never scored me a goal. It's never got me assist. It's never won a flick on. It's never done anything. So when we want to win a game with 20 minutes to go, that £15.8 million is useless to us, whereas Olivier Giroud wouldn't have been. So on the whole, I think it's been a good window. But for me, that decision, regardless of who we sold him to, selling him to Chelsea is even worse. But regardless of who he sold him to, I think it's a weird decision to get rid of him. And a lot of people have said, oh, you've got to grant him his wish. No, I support Arsenal Football Club. I like Olivier Giroud, but my first interest is Arsenal Football Club. Do we have a stronger squad with Olivier Giroud in it than we do with Olivier Giroud out of it and £15 million in the bank? The squad is stronger with him in it. So I get that I like him, and I get that he probably wanted playing time to go to the World Cup, but my interest is what benefits Arsenal. And Olivier Giroud sitting on a bench benefits Arsenal.
Was it anything to do with, because I know you were tweeting a couple of weeks ago about the wage structure and different things that we've got to come under the wages and stuff. Was that part of the plan why we got rid of Giroud, do you think?
I don't know, but it could be. I mean, I was going to come on to say this, that we lost five first-team players, well, either first-team or first-team squad players in this window and signed two, and we done it. I'm not sure if it was five. I tweeted we signed five and lost two. We lost five and brought two, and someone said it was exactly the same in the summer. I can't think who the fifth one was. Chesney, Gabriel, Gibbs, Ox, and I don't know who the other one was. But obviously, we only signed two in the summer. So even if it's only them four, we got rid of four players and only brought in two. So we're two light. And then this window's 5-2, so we're another three light. So we're five down, at least five down over two windows. Which, one, yes, will massively help with the wage bill issues that I was tweeting about before, but I think it leaves us very, very light as a squad. Like, if Hector gets injured now, God knows who plays at right back. Like, you're going to end up playing Chambers there, I assume, but Chambers was played there a few years ago and sent out on loan because he couldn't play. Like, he wasn't seen as a versatile option anymore, because when he did play out there, he wasn't good enough. So he got loaned out because he thought, well, he's only got future as a centre-back. We better get him minutes there. But it's the only option. As much as Debuchy isn't brilliant and it's a lot of money we've got off the wage bill, it's not. We've no longer got a backup right back, especially now we look like we're going to go back to a back four. As a wing back, there was half an argument that Reece Nelson could have played there. That argument doesn't stay the same as a right back, and maybe Maitland-Niles can play there, but he's never played there before. I mean, the way we built him up to play at left back was play him in the lesser games that don't really matter. But now we don't have any games that don't matter for the rest of the season unless we completely bomb off the league, which I don't think we're going to do. Because then you don't sign Aubameyang. If you think we're giving up on the league from this day, then you don't bother because he can't play in Europe anyway. So you'd say you're essentially signing him for a cup final. I think we'd left a squad there.
A lot of people were saying, like, you know, obviously we needed a centre back and Evans was hopeful. There was a question in there, Manalis was coming in, buyout clause. But we've got this Greek guy, and I know he's not ready, but he didn't go on loan. So do you think the club are thinking, well, let's give this guy a go on the back end of the season?
I mean, I'd be surprised because, look, I've not seen him play. I've spoke to people that have been to the under-23 games that he's played, and they said he looked half decent, like nothing groundbreaking, but looked the talent. But he's not going to come in and jump ahead of Holding and Chambers. You're thinking Chambers is... We had offers in excess of $20 million in the summer. So you say he's a £20 million defender. You look at Holding, and we only paid $2 million for him, but we'd get a hell of a lot more than that if we was to sell him now. And then this bloke sort of come in a bit under the radar for, I think, $1.8 million, $2.1 million, something like that. But I don't think he's an option to go in the first team. The problem we have is we only... If you assume that Mertesacker's not going to play anymore, which it seems likely after the Forest game, I think even the way he done his post-match interview, it sort of confirmed that. He said something like, oh, these players were auditioning to the first team, and I don't think any of us can say that anymore. So it kind of seemed like he's not expecting to play much anymore. We only actually have two senior actual centre-backs, in Mustafi and Koscielny. So I think they're looking for a defender in this window. And the reason Evans was targeted is because he is a senior centre-back. He's not world-class, but he is a senior centre-back. So I don't see the Greek boy being a contention for that because he may be good. He's definitely not senior. And I think that was the issue more than just wanting a centre-back. Wenger or whoever's doing the buy-in wanted a senior centre-back. And the problem was with Evans, we valued him at $18 million. West Brom valued him at $28 million. And the conversation started and ended with that. We'll offer you 18, we want 28. We're not going to that. Okay, see you later.
Now, it's probably the best window Arsenal's had in a long time.
Yeah, I mean, look, I've obviously just laid out the negatives. We've improved our attacking unit, definitely. Aubameyang is a natural-born finisher, so you'd hope he would take to the league. But then I was probably saying the same about Lacazette in June or July. But if Aubameyang does what we expect him to do, then, yeah, I genuinely believe we've improved. But I don't know, especially with the selling Giroud, I just feel like it could have been that one step better, the window. Yeah. But yeah, still, it was still our best transfer window in a long time.
Well, I think we need to digress a little bit, and we ask, what was your favourite Giroud moment? And I'll start with Schwinn. And I think it's a... mate, we should be playing this. So, Schwinn, what do you think, mate? Favourite Giroud moment?
Hard to say. I mean, obviously the scorpion kick comes to mind. That's a standout moment from his career, the one that got him the Puskás Award. So that's, of course, one of them. But, I mean, there's so many late winners. The man came off the bench and saved us so many times. And for all his faults and, you know, for the mistakes he made, which were plenty, he was a standout professional. I think that's something we're going to miss. You know, we've lost some of those players recently. I mean, we've been advocating for Coquelin and Theo Walcott and some of our fringe players to leave. But I don't think any of us ever touted Giroud to leave as, you know, for being a fringe player, which is what he was. He had a role and he did get those, you know, 10, 15 minutes at the end of every game that Lacazette started in the Premier League. But I think it's his professionalism that I'm going to miss a lot, and something that is going to stick with me in my memory, because he could have gone at the beginning of the summer, and he didn't, because he wanted to fight for the club. He wanted to fight for his position, but we just sort of, you know, made him even more peripheral, and that was a consequence. And, you know, as a consequence, he left. So of course that scorpion kick comes to mind, but honestly, there's so many of those late goals that, you know, that I could also throw into the mix.
Tony?
Yeah, I'm a bit controversial in that I hate the scorpion kick, not because it wasn't a good goal, but it's like what he's remembered for, and I think there's so much more to him than one very, very good goal. In terms of a single moment, I think it's difficult. You've got to mention his link-up play. It's part in the Wilshere goal. I don't need to single out one. We all know what I mean when I say the Wilshere goal was unbelievable, and there's not many others that could have done it. When Rizicki scored a very good goal, team goal, again, Giroud's part in it was crucial. I remember against Montpellier at home, a flick over the top for Lucas Podolski to smash in. Bournemouth away last year, flick over the top for Lucas Perez to smash in a volley. I think we're going to miss his build-up more. One moment that I particularly enjoyed was his equaliser at Old Trafford last year. We was absolutely dog shit for 93 and a half minutes. And in the last minute, he wins a header at the back post. And it wasn't a particularly brilliant goal, but he was half a torso above any of their defenders. He was almost at the same height as a crossbar. And he powerfully headed it in past De Gea to get us a 1-1 draw, to stop Mourinho beating us, when, in all honesty, we didn't deserve a thing from that game. And I just remember celebrating that in the crowd, because it felt like a robbery. So it was a moment that sticks with me. You have to say the two assists in the FA Cup final were unbelievable. There's so much to choose from, and for that reason, that's why I hate the scorpion kick. I just think there's so many to choose from, but the majority of people would say the scorpion kick because it was a good goal.
Since you touched on goals, I'll go something different. I just liked his attitude. He always tried 110%. He came on, and he was one of them players that just seemed to give everything to the club. You know, even when he looked up until the Swansea game yesterday, that I'm just watching a replay of. We might win this time, boys. You know, he come on off the bench and he still give everything he could, knowing. And I don't know whether the deal was in place yesterday, or the writing was on the cards that he was heading to Chelsea. But he come off that bench and he still tried his heart out. So for me, it was. He was a player that will be missed in Arsenal, I think. So, but heading to transfer news, and we'll bring in our guest now. It's Joseph.
Just quickly before we do that, sorry, Tez, and before we bring in Joseph, I think we should just slightly touch upon reports today of Mesut Ozil signing a contract extension.
Yeah, for sure. So, 2021 or 2022 or something?
21, 3.5 years extension.
Yeah.
Like a new signing, dare I say?
Huh?
Like a new signing, dare I say?
To be honest, I was just about to say, I mean, I don't not like a new signing, but the best signing of the window for us. And I know the majority of people will say Aubameyang because he's new, flashy and whatnot, but Ozil was irreplaceable. Is irreplaceable. So for me, that is the best sign, and I think that makes. So earlier, I may have sounded a bit down when I was saying it was five out and two in and whatnot, but re-signing Ozil makes up for it, but makes me feel a lot better about things.
I agree, and I mean, apart from the fact that he's a crucial cog in our build up and in our style of play. And as you said, irreplaceable in that. I think the damage in terms of the damage to the image of the club, if Mesut Ozil would have left, would have been disastrous. I mean, everyone knows the kind of a person Alexis Sanchez is, and for him leaving the club is still sort of understandable because of, you know, the character he is. But if Mesut Ozil had left, someone who was comfortable at the club, someone who enjoyed being at the club and enjoyed the city of London and has spoken about it profusely, I think if he decided to move away from London, I think that would have been a major, major blow to the image of Arsenal Football Club. And I mean, we're anyways not known for our transfer activity. Everyone accuses us of being slow and, you know, not making things happen quickly. But that would have been something which would have taken us down a really bad rabbit hole. So I agree. I think he's one of the most important players that, you know, we need to get on board in terms of a new contract. And I think we all can now focus on Jack and wait for him to sign an extension.
What I will just say quickly before we move on is I don't know her name, other people will, but God bless the future Mrs. Ozil. But if she didn't want to be in London, I think she would come.
Hear, hear.
So deadline day is done and dusted by the looks of it, 11 p.m. UK time, Tony. But we thought it'd be great to get a Joseph on. He's a Dortmund fan from America. How are you, Joseph?
How's it going? Thanks for having me.
No worries, mate. We just thought we'd get you on, mate, to talk about Aubameyang. And as a Dortmund fan in America, how does it feel that you've just lost your star player?
Well, it was a busy last few days in Dortmund. I can sleep easy knowing that we've kind of got a replacement in Michy Batshuayi. But it definitely is, you know, in my opinion, a big bummer that we're losing him. We're talking about a player who, in his time here, has scored 121 goals and 23 assists. He's our superstar. But that being said, I think it was the proper time for both parties to move on. Things had grown kind of stale with him at the club. He wanted an exit in the summer, which didn't happen. Understandably, because losing Dembele and Aubameyang in the same window would have been very bad for the club. Would not have been a good look. And so they had to hang on to Alba one more window. But ultimately, it didn't really end well because he kind of pulled a Dembele and forced his way out of the club, which, me personally, I don't really mind what he did. I understand where he was coming from. But there are definitely a lot of Dortmund fans who are very upset about the whole situation, and the dust is going to have to settle to really tell what the overall fan view of him is going to be. Yep. But I personally think it'll be a positive one.
Yeah, as Arsenal fans, understand how you feel, mate, because it's we had the similar problems with Sanchez. Tony, have you got any questions for Joseph, mate?
Yeah, so for the Arsenal fans that haven't really seen him play, they would have heard that obviously he's very quick and he scores a lot of goals. But a problem Arsenal tend to face is teams defend very deep, so there's no space in behind, which kind of nullifies pace. Obviously, I'm not saying he's just a pace merchant, but how does he tend to deal with team that just defend deep and come for a draw? Because I'm sure Dortmund, being one of the better teams in Germany, face them teams quite often as well, and his goal record is obviously unbelievable. So how does he deal with teams that don't allow him to use his pace?
That's a very good question. And like you said, I feel like most people who don't watch Dortmund, they kind of just assume that he's a pace merchant. They say, oh, well, he's just pace. He has no quality. But what I've noticed, and just over the years, as he's grown as a player, his finishing is really top class. I mean, it's up there. And he can chip a keeper like nobody else. Save for maybe Messi, but he likes to make long diagonal runs to be played out of the back on a counterattack. But when teams are, you know, packing nine people into the box, that is it really is where he struggles. He's not the best player with his link-up play and with his back to goal, and that's always been where he struggled. It's interesting, with Dortmund bringing in Batshuayi, he is a player who excels with his link-up play. So that'll be an interesting change for us. But that being said, Aubameyang is good in the air. He's a tall player. And when crosses get put in his direction, he can finish them off with his head. He's good with both feet. He's a player who he presses well. When Arsenal don't necessarily have the ball, he will chase down defenders and he'll close space very quickly, and use some of his pace. But Overall, I would definitely say he's more suited, obviously, to a counterattacking style of play. So that will help Arsenal when they're playing the big teams. And I really think that he'll do well when they don't necessarily have all of the possession in a match. You'll really see his strengths come out. But where he may struggle is playing some of the bottom teams who tend to pack it in. That being said, he's going to be surrounded by amazingly creative players in Ozil and now his ex-teammate at Dortmund, Henrik Mkhitaryan. And so I think that will help him out, and I really do think he'll succeed at Arsenal and be a great player.
Okay, Shwin, do you have any questions?
Yeah, so one of the questions that we've been dealing with, I mean, I know you said the last few days have been pretty crazy, but we've been hearing about Aubameyang for almost a month, and our listeners have been sending us queries about how potentially our four attackers, Aubameyang, Ozil, and Mkhitaryan, as you mentioned, and add Lacazette to the mix, we've been thinking of how they can be fit into our team. Now, the obvious one is that Aubameyang fits in as the nine. However, there are some people, including me, who think that he can play on the wing as well. So I know he started off on the wing at Dortmund, and it didn't really do well for him. But do you think he can fit into that mold as a winger, perhaps, or as a supporting striker at Arsenal?
Yeah, I was watching here in the States, it is NBC that is doing the coverage, and you know, someone said, well, he can just slot into the wing. And in my opinion, I think that you're losing his true quality when you just put him out there. He's not a player that is meant for that. He's fast. He could do fine on the wing, but I wouldn't rate him as the best dribbler. I wouldn't rate him as necessarily the most skillful player to slot into the wing. And I really think you lose his quality out there in front of goal. That being said, I know Lacazette is an amazing striker as well. And it's kind of a predicament, you know, how do they fit? So I totally understand that. If they were to switch to more of a two-striker system, I think that would be the way to get them both out there. That being said, I don't really know what Wenger is thinking. Having Ozil in behind the two of them would be immense. Potentially going to like a 4-2-2-2 and having Mkhitaryan on the right and Ozil on the left, that could also be something that would be interesting to look at. But yeah, I think it's a big predicament. All that being said, he can totally play on the wing and succeed. I just don't know if that's the best spot for him.
Mm-hmm. Tez?
Mate, Dortmund lost Mkhitaryan last year to Manchester United, and I know we've got Aubameyang and Mkhitaryan, so I don't want to take all the shine off Aubameyang. But how did you guys recover last season with his loss?
So yeah, that was a tough loss for us, but we happened to purchase one of the best young stars in all of Europe, who only happened to last one season with us before getting snatched up by Barcelona. So Dembele came. We purchased him for, I think, £13 million or euros. And everyone had pretty high expectations for him. We didn't really realize that he was going to be as good as he was. And so he slotted into that right wing position, and he did wonderful. We definitely missed out on the production from Mkhitaryan because he was an assisting machine in his last season with us. And now that he's back with Aubameyang, just look for nice square balls coming in from the right side to get finished off by Alba. But that being said, Dembele was just a great addition. Unfortunately, Barcelona was salivating over the chance of getting him, and he was just ready to, you know, fulfill his, as the players love to say, their childhood dream of going to that next club, much as Sanchez's childhood dream was to play for United. So I'm sure that you guys have experienced the similar pain that we feel as Dortmund fans very frequently. All that to be said, Mkhitaryan is brilliant. He's creative. He, honestly, his biggest weaknesses, in my opinion, are just his mentality. When he's not confident, you can tell. And it really, it weighs down on him. He's a very introspective person. I think that he thinks a lot. And so when his name's getting dragged through the mud in the press, it's very bad for him. And so he has to be, he has to have a manager behind him who is, you know, saying, hey, I believe in you. Go out there and do your thing. And that's when you'll see him thrive. So I've seen him at his best and at his worst. And when he really has it going, he's something special. And then I guess another thing to note, one of his other weaknesses, I would say, he makes a lot of bad tackles. A lot of times if he loses possession, he kind of just tries and wins it back. And he accumulated 17 yellow cards in his time at Dortmund, which is quite a lot for an attacking player. All that to be said, expect big things out of that duo. They work very well together, and seeing them reunited will be, it'll be a special thing. And I'll definitely be keeping my eye on it.
Yeah, nice, nice. Have you boys got anything else, Tony?
Yeah, I've got a couple more. So, firstly, I mean, I know you've just covered it, but with Mickey and Aubameyang, would you say that they have, you know, you get players that just have that bond and they know how to play together, much like Danny Drinkwater and Jamie Vardy did at Leicester in their title winning year? Or would you just say they just were your two best players? So it wasn't that they had like a special bond, it was just they were your two best players. So the goals and the assists came through them because it was essentially your creator and your scorer. Similar to how in years gone by, we've had Ozil getting a lot of assists for Giroud, and I wouldn't say they have a special link up, but it was our goal getter and our creator just doing their jobs.
Yeah, it's a very interesting question. I would say they do have good chemistry together, but I would also attribute a lot of their success together as just part of and a result of our system that year under Thomas Tuchel. We played a lot of diagonal balls out from Julian Weigl out to the wing, and then all of a sudden you got a square ball coming in to get finished off. It was just a lot of very quick, it would be a lot of possession that we would have, and then you'd see one or two quick passes and then bang, the ball's in the back of the net. And it was just the way our system worked. All of our play was coming in from the wings. And so that's where I would say their chemistry existed, and partially as a result of our system, partially as a result of them working well together. And I expect them to work well together at Arsenal, in truth. I really do.
Okay, thank you. Schwinn, do you have any more?
Oh, why don't you finish us up with one more question, Tony, and then maybe I'll switch tracks.
Okay, so this is a bit, this is not really on Mkhitaryan and Aubameyang. Obviously, we've taken Sven, the chief scout, from you. Over here, we're getting reports of how brilliant he has been, and obviously, everyone's naming the great names that he spotted, as you mentioned, Dembele. Kagawa is obviously a big coming for next to nothing consult for 20-odd million. Obviously, it was him who spotted Aubameyang. But we've not heard any negatives, really. So has it all been positives, or has he brought in some people that are terrible, but they've just not been reported?
You know, that's an interesting question. I would say overall, I would rate him very highly. He seems to be able to just find, he has the eye for the talent, and, you know, all of a sudden they develop into these amazing players. You look at Christian Pulisic, and just as these other young players we're bringing in, Dan Axel Zagadou, you know, he's another center back with a bright future. But then there's players that we've brought in, young kids, and they've not necessarily materialized at Dortmund. One in particular that I'm thinking of is Mikel Merino. He gets brought in as a teenager, and all of a sudden plays a few years. All of a sudden, they get rid of him, and they say, you know, we're going to let you go. We don't think that you're fit for our midfield. And whether that's down to the manager at the time, just not really appreciating him. All of a sudden, he goes to Newcastle, and he's been having, you know, a pretty decent year. And in all truth, I'd be pretty happy if he was playing in our midfield instead of a player like Gonzalo Castro right now. But I mean, and that's just one example. There's always players who come in and they don't necessarily develop. But I would definitely say for the most part, he does an amazing job. And you can expect your youth system to really reap the benefits of it. And you'll feel the effects in the senior team in no time. Give it a few seasons and he'll find some gems that no one's ever heard of, you know, and he'll find them and get them out there on the pitch.
Just a very quick question to add on because I know we're trying to wrap it up. Do you think that because of his eye for talent, you sometimes, and it's a thing I worry for with Arsenal, that you start signing youth talent rather than looking at the experience market? Because, I mean, we've obviously been linked with Malcolm from Bordeaux, and he comes with the price of a senior player, but and the potential to be a great player, but he's not quite there yet. Did you notice that similar sort of, I don't know if it's a problem, but that similar sort of issue?
No, yeah, I would actually completely agree with that. And I was thinking about that today. We bring in these young, talented players for next to nothing. They develop and then we sell them for a pretty high transfer fee. And then we reinvest in youth and not buying senior players. I was actually having this discussion with someone on Twitter today. I personally would like to see them spending the 70 million Aubameyang cost to reinvest it in the squad right now for today. Because thinking about tomorrow all the time, it doesn't always bring the best results on the pitch. For just an example, I think we need a new central midfielder. We don't have a true box-to-box player. I would love to see them splurge cash on, someone like Roger Nainggolan or someone in that category and say, okay, their wages will be high and the transfer fee may be high, but what's going to improve the team the most today? And I would agree. I think it's a problem that Dortmund has right now, and many fans would echo that. But then you have to understand Dortmund's financial troubles in the past. We don't have a big wage bill. We don't have, all of this. We don't have oil money, backing us. We don't have deep pockets, if you will. And so the club always has taken a more conservative approach, and their philosophy is we're going to develop youth and we'll get them on the field and turn them into great players. And I would say, for the most part, it works. You see players like Royce and Götze, amazing world-class players that have come up through our youth ranks. And so, yeah, I guess that's a very interesting question, and I would agree it can be seen as a problem.
Okay.
Speaking of, sorry, Tony, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, I was just gonna say that's me done.
Yeah, I mean, speaking of youth players, for our listeners who don't know Joseph, he's based in Atlanta in the U.S. and I'm sure you guys remember of me talking on and on about Ezequiel Barco, who has now joined Atlanta United. So, Joseph, I'm sure there's a lot of excitement in the city. I mean, I know hashtag Barco Watch was a big thing on Atlanta Twitter. And I was keeping, tabs on that. So what's the emotion around the city, and what is expected from this young world beater?
Yeah, no, it's the mood is great. We're excited that it finally came through. It was a long process, and there were times we didn't think the transfer was going to go through for various reasons, but I would say we're very ready for March 3rd when they open up at Houston. Our squad is young, they're fast, they're exciting. Last year was it was honestly a dream for a lot of the people in the city of Atlanta. I mean, we've grown up soccer fans, as you say, football. We've grown up football fans, and we've had no football team to watch to call our own. And it really is something special to be able to say and put on the jersey and go to the game and say, man, this is the team that represents my city. it takes it to a whole nother level. Yeah, the quality in MLS isn't the same as some of the other top leagues around the world, but that's okay. You know, it's different. As for Barco, he's very quick, very shifty, great vision. He's going to complement our attackers very well. He'll get the ball into Joseph Martinez, and, you know, Joseph will do his thing, and he should work well with another person who's been linked to Arsenal, Miguel Almiron, who, if you guys do get your hands on him, he is quite the talent. Maybe not the size right now for the Premier League, but if he puts on a few pounds, he could be quite a handful for Premier League defenders.
Well, thanks, Joseph, for coming on the show today, mate, and talking to the Arsenal fans about Aubameyang and Mkhitaryan. Mate, muchly appreciate it. You can follow Joseph at Dauntment America. And, Joseph, we might get you on if we come across you in one of the Europa League or something, mate.
Hey, thanks for having me. And the way that it always seems to go, I wouldn't be too surprised if we meet each other down the road in the Europa League this year. So thanks for having me. I enjoyed it. Best of luck to Arsenal in the future. And I will be keeping close tabs on Aubameyang. And I wish him all the best. He's truly a special player, and you guys will enjoy watching him. He'll bring a smile to your face with his, you know, fun-loving and flashy style. He's someone who loves the game, and you'll really enjoy him. So thanks for having me.
Thank you, Joseph. That was a very interesting chat, lads. What do you think, Tony?
Yeah, I mean, as I said, I told everyone earlier on that I was going to ask about how he deals with packed defences, and that we all know he's a good finisher and finds space. It was interesting that he said it was probably one of his weaker areas. But, I mean, as I said, Dortmund are a better team than most of the teams in their league, so he's obviously dealt with it in the past. Whether he struggled but dealt with it, that's fine. I also found it interesting that he said that his link-up play was probably not the best, but that maybe will bring Lacazette into his own, in the sense in that Lacazette can drop in and do the link-up play that he is very good at. And instead of at the moment where Lacazette comes short and looks forward and there's no one in front of him because he's the guy that's meant to be in front of him, now there will be someone in front of him. So maybe they can bring out the best in each other. And it may be that Lacazette doesn't score as much. But if there's someone there doing that job, then that's fine. I think the problem with Lacazette at the moment is he's doing the stuff that looks nice, but he's not getting on the end of it. So me especially, and obviously some others, notice it more.
Yeah. Enjoy that, Schwinn.
Yeah, I think it did us and our listeners a few good favors in terms of, you know, sort of outlining where he fits well. I know we've talked about whether he's going to fit on the wing or if he's going to be more central. And I think he's in accordance with Tony there that he will be our focal point in our attack. And of course, when it comes to his connection with Mkhitaryan, which again, he spoke about, I think that's another thing to watch out for. We've really added a threat, and not just a threat that will, you know, have to rely on his own capabilities. You know, we've added a new dimension almost to our attack where Henrik Mkhitaryan and Aubameyang are going to make defenders think. We've been flat in a little single dimensional at the moment, and I think that's going to give defenders something else to think about. So Everton, Tottenham, whoever it is that we get to see our new front line in action, bring it on, because I'm rubbing my hands as we speak.
Well, before we go and say thank you and see you later, everybody, we'll just touch very quickly. We've got a game coming up in 3 days' time against Everton. Tony, quick, I know you don't do a prediction, but I'm going to keep asking you every week for a prediction. I'll probably get the 10-0. But Aubameyang, he starts, and Mkhitaryan, what's your thoughts there, mate?
So I think Aubameyang kind of has to, even though like, he probably didn't. He may have trained today, but he almost certainly didn't. Well, actually, no, he wouldn't have done a training session with the team because they wouldn't have been in. So he'll only have 2 days training. But after the result the other day, when you've got this new shiny toy, you kind of have to play him, because if we would have won the other day, and I think it's partially why Mkhitaryan didn't start against Swansea, was because with that same team pretty much, I know Jack in for Ramsey due to illness, but Ramsey in for Jack, that same team had dismissed Palace and beat Chelsea. So I wasn't surprised that he didn't change that. But then when you've had the bad result, I think he has to. I think it will be interesting to see how he fits them all in, because if you assume Aubameyang goes in up top, then where does Lacazette go? If you say he goes in for Iwobi, does Mkhitaryan stay on the bench? It'd be interesting to see how he fits them all in. Mm-hmm. But I would say that Aubameyang has to start, and I'd be absolutely amazed if he doesn't, to be honest.
Schwinn?
Well, firstly, it's the return of Theo Walcott to the Emirates. He scored a brace today, so he's making it onto the score sheet. And I think on his first appearance, he made an assist as well. So I expect the Emirates faithful to welcome him and not really boo him. And I don't think they will boo him. I think we had a good relationship, and we parted ways at a decent time. So that's something to watch out for. In terms of the lineup, I don't know. I actually don't think we'll see Aubameyang start. I actually don't even think we'll see Mkhitaryan start, if I'm honest. I don't think Arsene's going to force them in. I can easily see a similar lineup, and maybe Jack back in for Ramsey if Jack's back in. But anyone's guess is as good as mine at this point, because I mean, even before these changes, we didn't know whether to expect a back three or back four. So I think it's safe to say that we can expect a back four, but when it comes to the to our attacking line and our attacking midfielders, all I know for sure is that Mesut Ozil will play unless he's injured or sick. But I really don't know who else is going to feature.
You want to give a prediction?
2-1 to the Arsenal.
Yeah, I'll go 3-1 Arsenal. Aubameyang scores.
You were going to say 2-1, weren't you?
I was, actually. I just had a quick look at the odds, and I'm converted to you guys. I haven't. But Australian Arsenal, $1.25 favourites. Everton, $11. Bookies know something. So I'll go 3-1 on them odds. Okay, boys, let's wrap it up. We'll be back on after that game, which we'll record Sunday. That'll be out on Monday. So
it'll be out Sunday UK time.
Sunday UK time, okay. Yeah, Monday Australian time. So, and thank you everybody for your support. You guys have been amazing. Stats have been amazing. Yous are all over the world, and we appreciate everybody, you know, supporting us, listening to the podcast, liking us on Twitter, retweeting, having conversations with the boys on Twitter. I'll also give a quick shout out to Savvy and Carl doing amazing jobs with the boys, the Arse View, and a couple of the other boys at the clockandtalk.blog. I had a look, and them boys are doing some good stuff over there too, so check them out. Thanks again, boys.
No worries, thanks for having me.
Thanks.
Cheers.
I'll see yous all on Sunday.
Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang is a goner.